This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
Welcome to the Making Conversation Australian Composers Podcast. These are the opening moments of Timothy Tate's piano trio, Formings. We'll come back to this piece in a minute, but it was about musical formings that we began to talk when I met up with Timothy last year in London. This is Chris Williams, and today I'm sitting down, not far from Regent's Park in central London, at the Royal Academy of Music. So if you hear a few background notes, that's why. And sitting across from me is the composer Timothy Tate. Timothy, welcome to Making Conversation.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
I wondered if we could begin with if you could tell us a little bit about your background, how it is that you came to be here in London and where you started making music.
So originally I started making music here in the UK, actually. I was born here, and then I would have moved when I was seven, that's right, to Brisbane. But I started making music, primarily singing, and then playing the piano and violin here in the UK, and then really focused on violin and singing in Australia. Moving to composition as I sort of began to experiment more as I grew up. But I did my bachelor's in composition at the Queensland Conservatorium of Music, graduating in 2010, and finally found my way here to the Royal Academy of Music to do my master's in 2014. And I'm drawing to the close of that master's now.
So in some senses, being in the UK is like a homecoming for you?
As I was quite young, it's hard to really remember what was sort of the feeling of being in the UK. But to some degree, I think being an adult returning, it does feel almost like fulfilling a childlike sort of ambition to come home again. But specifically one of actually studying in the UK and wanting to really come back and do that, especially after doing a bachelor's.
And are there many differences that you've noticed between Australia and England in terms of studying or your musical worlds?
I think mainly the differences lie in the fact that there are much more people here in the UK, and there's a lot more diversity. You don't have just sort of one culture predominating. You have so many coming from Europe, as well as coming from Australia and then America and some of the Asian countries as well. So you feel like there's much more diversity, but also there's many more people doing the same thing that you're doing in several institutions being here in London. So there is a vibrant community that's really sort of ripe for the picking.
Do you think that you found that you have a larger audience over here in the United Kingdom?
I think there's very much more of a tradition, and it's been built up over the years. So there is an audience that's perhaps already familiar with the contemporary repertoire that I'm writing in. But it has felt like there's been more people who do come to concerts, and I think more people of my generation who are really wanting to put on concerts, not just sort of one or two, but there's quite a few different things happening, sometimes even on the same night. So it feels like there's a really big community sort of push, not just from people actually, coming to see the concerts, but the composers and performers who are a part of it.
I asked Timothy to think back to the early days when he was living in Brisbane, and if he could remember the first piece of music he ever composed.
I think compose would be a very sort of loose term. I stopped learning piano when I came to Australia. And I kept playing though, and I used to transcribe hymns that we had somehow sung, I think, in chapel at school. And I used to start transcribing them by ear and then reworking them. And I think out of that, I almost started writing my own pieces at sort of the age of 8 or 9. But it's a very blurry kind of a line between what I was sort of transcribing, what I was composing. I've always been drawn to trying to set text. And I've done that on a number of occasions, both for choir and then both for chamber ensembles with the vocalist. But it sort of did start, I think, being in the UK and then being a choral tradition. It is what sort of started my musical life, and it's sort of always been a part of who I am as a musician, as a composer. I always feel like I can draw it back to being a chorister.
Wonderful. So, thinking back on this image of a young Timothy who is transcribing by ear at the piano, I guess there came a point where you were writing down notation.
So, I think the early kind of writing of the compositions sort of coincided with the use of both sort of MIDI keyboard and Sibelius. We had that at our school in Brisbane. So I started experimenting with that, but not happy with sort of the results as I kept on going, you know, being a computer programmer and all. I think it would have been around the age of sort of 12 or 13 I started really writing things down. But it was actually my composition teacher, Jared Brophy, who I studied with in the last 2 years of my high school, that really encouraged me to just write everything down and explore it on the page, much more than I had been doing previously, sort of moving between using, say, Sibelius or writing sort of bits and pieces down at the piano.
So you've mentioned Jared Brophy. So you were working with him when you were high school and then also in your undergraduate, is that right?
Yes, so Jerry was my teacher through my bachelor's, but I was working with him 2 years prior to studying there, around 2 years.
And was he a big influence on the way that you started to think about how music could be written down?
I wouldn't say that he was a massive influence in the way of writing music. I think he refined the way I thought about how music needed to be presented to performers in that sense. But he began to show me how to order music on the page rather than just, say, improvising at the piano, and finding a way to explore what I had written and make it much more than sort of just the thing that had come out.
I realised that in the introduction I sold you short. I said that you were a composer, but you're also a distinguished performer. So you perform on viola and other instruments as well?
Mainly viola now. So alongside my composition studies here at the Academy, I'm also a second study violist. So I play anywhere from solo to playing in orchestras, freelancing around London, but always with a focus on contemporary music. So I've luckily enough, being at the Academy doing second study, I've had the opportunity to see almost the psychology of notation, how, you know, being on the other side of the paper, having to interpret music.
There's a distinguished lineage of viola players who are also composers. Do you think that playing the viola, or indeed just being a performing musician, informs the way that you think about composing?
I'll always say that, you know, the composer's instrument is the viola, but I think I'd be selling that short if I said that if you didn't play the viola, you're not a good composer. But I think we underestimate the importance of being able to perform and having performance as something that is either current in our musical lives as a composer, or it's been there beforehand. So I think it's a really, whatever instrument you play, it's a really important part of actually being a composer, because it takes you away from the theoretical and really into what is sound doing, and what is the reality of the marks and the ideas that you're putting down on paper.
Now, going back a little bit to talking about when you first started writing things down, you did mention Sibelius, which is, of course, a computer program for notating. And I know that you have in the past handwritten scores as well. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about how you work now.
So you mentioned when I composed early on, I used Sibelius. And that was more of a mucking around, kind of putting things in the computer and seeing what came out. Of course, Sibelius now is really an engraving tool for most composers. But you have the luxury of being able to play back as well. Now I really use it as sort of the latter, as a typesetting tool. It's in an institution like the Royal Academy, where you're really pressed to write quite a lot of music. And it's really challenging, you know, in the sense that it's preparing us for what may come ahead as a commissioned composer. Finding a way to work with a computer program that allows you to typeset and allows you to produce music quickly has been quite Working with a program like Sibelius, which allows you to typeset quite quickly, really makes you develop a way of working on the paper first and then putting into computer second, whether that be short scoring and then developing in the computer, or writing out in full score and then translating into the computer, as really is a traditional sort of engraving way of working. My method sort of lies between I will short score certain sections and put them in the computer, but sometimes I need to write them out fully by hand to actually be able to really feel what, you know, what I'm doing, or take my time to see what the music needs to do. I think there's what I've learnt more as I've gone on using a computer program like Sibelius is that you have to be very clear in your ideas before you get them in the computer. It's almost like having a clarity, or compositional clarity, or even the structural clarity before they get in the computer. Otherwise, that can very much limit the way you expand and explore those ideas.
And where do you usually compose?
Ever since coming to the Academy, I will say everywhere. But my favourite place is either at home, which is in East Finchley, London, for me at the moment, or at a good coffee shop with an Antipodean flair, which are quite common in London now, thank goodness. But going back to the point I made before about needing to use a program like Sibelius as something that you can put ideas into that you've already explored and know the potential for, a lot of my writing occurs sort of in those sort of bursts of working out things on the paper and working out how to explore them, which then allows me to, so if that's in an environment like home, I can have the time and space to work through those ideas. But then if I need to work on the fly, I've almost already worked out how to develop those, and putting them in the computer becomes quite quick.
So you mentioned having bursts of ideas there. I wonder if the word inspiration means something to you. Do you believe in the idea of inspiration?
I think inspiration is that moment where you discover what the piece is going to be about. At the beginning of writing a piece, there's always that moment where you don't know how to really go forward. You're really feeling in the dark. And I think when you really have that aha moment, you almost will learn the grammar or the syntax of the piece and you can start writing. That's almost where the inspiration really ends, and it's about really developing those ideas. Whilst, you know, that sounds quite sort of cold cut, that doesn't make sense. While that sounds quite brutal, in a sense, it's when you understand what you've got in front of you, I think that's when the imagination can really take off. But it's all about the hard work. It's all about really working out where those ideas can go. But it's always comes down to me at the beginning of the compositional process. What comes down, this gets more fun as it goes along. For me, it's the idea of finding the grammar of a composition, which really starts in that inspiration process. when starting a piece.
So inspiration and hard work are inextricably linked then?
I think so, but I think it's as any composer will know, once you've got an idea, it's merely an idea. You have to really kind of go with it and see where it can go. But there's a lot of process between, you know, coming up with an idea and taking it somewhere, and it's about how you find that. And I think it's the inspiration kind of lurks in different places. It would be too straightforward to say that the inspiration comes first and then the composition comes second. So a lot of my composition process is based on hearing, based on almost an intuition, knowing or trying to assess something that I've written and seeing if it's worth going ahead with. And that's by listening to it mainly. But it's about assessing the potential of an idea. I think from the outset, knowing whether it's something that's closed or it's open. And what I mean by that is, if it's quite an open idea, there is room for ambiguity, whereas a closed idea, in a sense, is almost fully formed. So I try to work between finding something that is quite open, that will allow for transformation. But if I have a closed idea that I've worked at, I know where I want to get to with that idea. It's sort of a process of working towards that, or sort of reverse engineering and working out how can I tease certain sort of parts of this out into something that will lead towards this fully formed idea. So it's really about understanding what's the potential of an idea, and how that then fits into the structure or the grammar of the piece.
One of the things I love about Timothy's music is exactly this, how he works with the potential of an idea, as he put it. It often begins with something small and simple and builds out into something much more elaborate and grand. I asked Timothy to tell us a little bit about the piece we heard at the beginning of the podcast, Formings. I promised you we'd get back to it.
So Formings is a piano trio, but it's a piano trio for violin, clarinet, and piano. I've played in the viola, clarinet, piano trio, which is a very different beast to the violin and clarinet piano trio. The violin really increases the tension within the ensemble and actually creates three very, very different characters, whereas the viola and the clarinet in that form of the trio usually blend quite nicely, and there is a sort of ability for perspective there. So going into the trio, I was really wanting to create a identity for each of the instruments. And this is where I started, and this is where almost the whole idea of the piece came out. So I suppose the grammar of the piece. The piece is in three movements, but material or ideas move between the movements, or referenced between the movements, to create almost a homogeneous kind of feel. The movements that are played without a break. The general idea within the piece is of creating almost a sort of suspended animation, trying to stop time and create a world in which the violin and clarinet will operate as a duo, and the piano will respond and try and break up that duo. So that idea forms the first movement. But we have sort of elements of that which recur in the third movement, where a melodic line is traced by each instrument individually throughout the ensemble and throughout that movement. Thank you. But the second movement is almost this sort of intermezzo, or almost like night. It's almost a nocturnal feel. A nocturnal movement where it's bridging, but it's transitioning into this this sort of individual world in the third movement. But in a sense, what I was trying to work out with this piece was how to sort of spin a movement or spin a kind of character out of a very, very limited amount of material. And in a way, this piece is really based on sort of intervallic series, augmented fourths separated by major seconds, and then contractions of these intervals. And it's all about moving around that and working out how long that can go before it really becomes a little bit too much. So in a sense, it was trying to create ambiguity out of that, but then direction and trajectory.
So for any listeners who maybe don't have a musical background, when you say intervallic series, what does that mean exactly?
So we've got intervals then on the piano, like a major triad is made out of a major third and a minor third. And that's what makes that, that's the identity in a sense of that triad. But what I'm interested in is using these intervals outside of a major or minor or a triadic context and stacking them so you can have the same interval constantly repeating and it will give you a certain flavor. But if you interpolate another interval within that, it gives you another very different feeling. In a sense, it gives you across a very low to high range. It gives you a sense of identity that you can maintain.
So it's almost like, it's a sequence of notes that give a very particular character to whatever the piece is that you're working on. Would that be fair?
Yes, definitely.
Well, why don't we listen to the very opening of Formings and then talk about it? And so, Timothy, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
So I spoke earlier about how there's almost an intervallic identity within the writing of this piece. And what's happening is in this opening with the clarinet and violin, there is a presentation of an augmented fourth and a perfect fifth. And these are sort of the two intervals that are really defining this movement. And this presentation, this almost quite still contrapuntal world between the violin and clarinet, is something that is articulated and then interrupted It's articulated by the two instruments, but is then interrupted by the piano with a completely different feel, almost like a jazz feel. And the piano sort of continues in this vein throughout the piece, trying to sort of interrupt this duet that is going on between the violin and clarinet. And this is sort of where that idea of sort of intervallic character or identities come out, because the violin and clarinet really stick to sort of their sort of pairing, whereas the piano is moving quite liberally around these structures that I create, these sort of intervallic sequences. But the structure of the piece is quite simple in a way, because that opening that the violin and clarinet set up, which then goes into a sort of an extended sequence when the piano interrupts, is merely ornamented and sort of expanded with the piano playing almost just vertical chords, whereas before it had been playing arpeggiated figures. So in a sense, it really is kind of a play between sort of this intervallic character and identity, but also about how they're presented, whether they're arpeggiated, whether they're block chords, or whether there's like a linear counterpoint between the two instruments, and whether that is really heavily ornamented. So in a sense, the component parts are quite simple. It's just the textural identities are what really define how the piece moves.
We've already started to answer this question a little bit, but I wonder if you could maybe suggest what it is about your music that makes it sound like your music.
That's a very interesting question, because it's something I've only really been able to understand or answer in the last few months. And it's actually been about completing my studies at the Academy that I've really found this sort of question out, or found the identity to my music. I could be wrong, because, you know, music changes. But at the moment, I feel like what I try to do in my pieces that give them the certain identity is create a space and create a sense of architecture that I have to fill. And I think quite linear. I think in quite a linear fashion about this. But it's about presenting, I've talked about ambiguity before, but it's about presenting ideas sort of in an ambiguous form, so they can reform, they can take certain identities within this space, within this architecture. But by the time you've listened to the piece, you know where you've gone. Even while listening, you've felt like you're at sea. By the end of the piece, in a sense, those strands or those sort of unanswered questions that I've put to the listener at the beginning of the composition are almost tied up, either consciously or subconsciously, by the end. That's perhaps a grand claim, but I suppose that's where I strive towards, creating a sense of ambiguity as well as a sense of quite... whatever the opposite of ambiguity is. I have to think about I suppose it's between ambiguity and certainty, what the difference between that is, and how, when setting up an ambiguity in a piece, there is a clarity that is also presented, and how they interact. And that's in a way how I am trying to navigate in my musical landscape.
So if nobody ever heard your music, would you still write it?
Definitely. Because I think the act of writing, especially in a world like today where there is so much music, for me, writing music is about ordering my experiences, but also wanting to communicate to people, even if they weren't going to listen. It's in a way of getting something out. But on the other side, it's a way of ordering, and it's a way of making sense of a world that you create, or that is somehow created for you. I think it's important to be able to express oneself and be able to sort of comment on what's happening around us in a very, very shifting world.
We now move on to a few hypothetical questions for you. I'm going to begin with the classic hypothetical, which is the dinner party question, but I'm going to rephrase it slightly. So if you were to invite three composers, alive or dead, to take a stroll with you in the Vienna woods, who would they be and why?
That's a tricky one, Chris. Let me think. I've got two. Let's see if I can get a third. They're all dead so far. So if I had to take a stroll in the Vienna woods with three composers, I'd have to say I would choose Elliot Carter, Alban Berg, and Claude Debussy.
It's an interesting combination. Why would those be the three that you would go for?
I chose Debussy because I'm interested in how he constructed so much of his music. In a sense, there is so much behind what you see on the page, whilst there's this idea of an impressionistic sort of freedom that is really pervading much of the music of that era. In a way, there was something that was so controlled behind the page, and in his compositional language and methodology, which would be an incredible thing to unpick, even in just a stroll through the Vienna woods. But Carter, because of my interest in how he dealt with harmony and how he redefined his own sort of personal language, not just harmony, but through rhythm. And through texture of instrumental writing, and also because of his ability to know, his ability to write incredibly intricate music on a very small level. I say Alban Berg because, in a sense, he had such a personal take on Schoenberg's serialism. There was an essence to his music that was strikingly original and him down to a T.
Finishing up, we have a question from one of our generous project patrons, Cameron Lamb, who is himself a composer, and he asks, "What outside of music most inspires you and/or your work?"
I would have to say it's architecture in a way, and it's about. For me, it's a lot about modern architecture to do with I suppose, brutalist concrete, if we want to go back to that sort of modernist 60s, 70s aesthetic. But it's about seeing how an architect has dealt with space and dealt with light and dealt with balance and form. I suppose those are some words that are really quite key to my music. So in a way, that's probably one of my go-to. The second would be literature, specifically poetry, for again the same reason, the balance, the weight of the language versus the way it needs to communicate.
Thanks for talking to us today, Timothy. Where can people find you and your music on the interwebs?
You can find me on my website, which is www.timothytate.com.au.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chris.
In this episode, we heard excerpts from two of Timothy's works. Formings was performed and recorded by Trio Mirage at the Royal Academy of Music in London. The work for choir heard earlier in the episode is called Veils, performed by Blossom Street Singers and recorded at Regent's Hall, London. And finally, we're listening now to Endless Present, performed by Katie Ovens, Henry Clay, Charlie Dale Harris, Alice Quayle, Charlie Ransley, Chris Hart, Quinn Parker and Gwen Reed. Conducted by Oscar Colomina Ebosk, recorded in St. Mark's, London, engineered by the composer, and we are very grateful for permission to include these recordings.
Making Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign,
Project patron Cameron Lamb of Kamaklang, and Creative Partnerships Australia's Match Funding Program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic Prozic. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.